At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hello, I'm Justin Rowlatt from the BBC's Business Daily in London.
I'm Kai Rizdahl from Marketplace in Los Angeles.
Today, we're going truly global for a unique transatlantic collaboration.
The BBC World Service and American Public Media are joining forces to explore how the Eurozone crisis is affecting the whole world.
Welcome to an extended edition of Business Daily, bringing you the best of our combined journalism. In the next half hour,
the all-too-real costs of the Eurozone crisis.
All fruit has doubled in price. All fruit. From South Africa, from Europe, it's all doubled in price.
We'll be chasing the ripples from that crisis onto the streets of Los Angeles, Jiangsu, and Nairobi.
And if the world's biggest bond trader is right, then this is only the beginning of our troubles.
The time to get out is roughly equivalent to the time to get in, sort of biblical in a way, you know, 7 years of lean following 7 years of fat.
That's all in Business Daily from the BBC.
Well, when the architects of Europe's single currency were drawing up their plans for the euro, a crisis of the scale and magnitude it is currently experiencing would have been the stuff of their very worst nightmares. Indeed, the whole idea of the euro was that it would be a force for stability, the coping stone of the great project for Europe's post-war integration. That aspiration was summed up by the EU's finance commissioner at the time of the new currency's creation, Yves Thibault de Silguy.
290 million people will have in their pockets the same currency. Europe will have a voice on the international scenes. And that is very important, first for its identity, secondly to defend its interest, and thirdly to participate to the rebuilding of the international monetary system.
The euro was a key part of Europe trying to make sure the devastation brought by wars started in Europe would never happen again. And when the euro was launched just 12 years ago, the general mood was optimism, even though back then there were pessimists, saying a single currency between the two very different economies of Europe simply couldn't work. Pessimists like British economist Doug McWilliams.
If it survives the next 18 months, then it will probably survive at least the next 4 or 5 years. And I'd give it, in, say, 10 years' time, about a 1 in 5 chance of surviving.
And those pessimists seem to have been vindicated. As leaders of the G20 group of nations head towards their summit in the south of France, they will not be cheered by the news from Greece. 1 week on from Europe's latest comprehensive solution to the crisis, and it's already looking a whole lot less, well, comprehensive. On Monday, the Greek Prime Minister told Parliament that he plans to hold a referendum on the latest round of austerity measures.
We have a duty to give priority and highlight the role and responsibility of the citizen, showing in practice not only our respect, but also our fundamental thinking that this citizen is the source of our strength and of our very existence. This, dear colleagues, is the referendum.
And so on Tuesday, the Greek cabinet gave its unanimous backing to the referendum plan. If the Greek people vote no, though, and that's what opinion polls suggest they will do, the very future of the euro could be in doubt. So one obvious question, Justin, becomes how all this craziness in Europe is affecting the mood around the world. You guys just did a poll at the BBC on that subject. What'd you find out?
Well, yeah, we polled 25,000 people across 25 countries. It was undertaken by GlobeScan for the BBC between July and September this year. And respondents were asked to say what they whether they expected good or bad economic times in the next year and also over the next 5 years. Now, the poll shows that Japanese, British and French consumers are amongst the most pessimistic across the countries polled.
Tell me about the rest of the world, though.
Yeah, well, that's what's so interesting, Kai. There is lots of optimism elsewhere in the world. Now, this is the third year that the poll has measured economic confidence around the world. So if we focus just on the change in consumer confidence since 2010, most of the countries seeing the biggest increases are in the developing world, with the biggest rises in Kenya, up 24 points since 2010, Mexico, up 23 points, Turkey, up 16, and Indonesia and Germany, yep, one European country in there, each up 14. Africa, for example, comes out as the most optimistic continent of them all.
So draw me the big conclusion then.
Well, if there is a big conclusion, it is that people in developing countries are much, much more confident about their futures than those in developed countries. Let's take Asia, for example. The two economic giants of Asia, China and India, are the most upbeat among the Asian countries we surveyed, with over half of respondents expecting business conditions to be good next year. People are similarly optimistic in Indonesia and the Philippines, but take a look at the two richest countries in the region. Take a look at Japan and Australia. The story is very different there. Just 5% of Japanese people expected good times ahead, 1 in 20, and people are nearly as gloomy over in Australia. So the clear message, Kai, is that the developed world is in the doldrums and developing countries are feeling much, much more upbeat.
Yeah. And so we decided to try to put those results into a bit of context. We got out into the streets ourselves. Justin, the BBC's poll says that Britons are among the most pessimistic about their futures of any country questioned. So you went out the other day to a market in the middle of West London's Notting Hill to see how West Londoners are feeling about their situation.
So I've come down to what used to be one of London's busiest markets, to Portobello Road, to find out how people here feel about their future. Now, this place, on the weekends, is absolutely heaving, but during the week, it is a pale shadow of its weekend self.
How are you, sir? All right? The blueberries are lovely, but they're 180, but they are very nice.
Market trading is in fruit seller Peter Kane's blood, but at the moment, he's struggling.
My family's been here 3-4 generations, like a lot of other stallholders down here. But the supermarkets, you know, they've killed the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, they've done them all.
But you've got more problems now, haven't you? Because you import a lot of this stuff from Europe. Presumably the prices of fruit from Europe have gone up because of the exchange rate.
Absolutely.
So you've got some oranges there from Spain. How has the price changed on those?
Well, they've doubled in price.
Doubled?
They've doubled. All fruit has doubled in price. All fruit. From South Africa, from Europe, it's all doubled in price.
So how is it affecting you personally?
Personally? Well, I'm looking for a moneylender. That's how it's affecting me personally. It's not good, mate. It's awful. It's just awful. I mean, I needn't say anything. Just look.
Yeah, we're just looking either way down the street.
Can you see how many market traders are out today?
Normally the market would be full. We've got, what, three market traders out? And then we've got, how many customers are there on the street?
Well, four.
Would you be able to see this thing out?
I really don't think so, no.
Are you serious, or are you just...
No, I'm serious. I am serious. I mean, I'm the last person to, like, my father had this before that, my grandfather before that, and all that ago. But I've got a daughter who works in advertising. I'm sure she don't want to be standing there in the market, you know. We can't do anything. Just, they will say, keep punching, that's all we can do.
Cheers, Peter. Thank you very much.
There you go, mate.
Have you got a moment?
I do.
Has the economy, the changes in the economy, have they affected you?
Yeah, of course. For starters, it's hard to get work. So I'm out of work.
You're unemployed?
I'm unemployed.
Is that, and do you think that's a result of the kind of recession that Britain's been going through?
Yeah, definitely, because I work as a gardener. I go from basically from contract to contract. And I've noticed that there's less work. So I'm spending sort of more time at home.
And what about shopping? What about going out and buying things here in the market?
I've noticed in the supermarkets, there's been a few instances when I've got home and I've been certain that I've forgotten a bag at a supermarket, and all it is just that things are just much more expensive. You're just getting a lot less for the same amount of money.
You're listening to a unique transatlantic collaboration between Justin Rowlatt of the BBC's Business Daily
and me, Kai Rizdahl, from American Public Media's Marketplace. Still to come in the program, how even Chinese companies are being affected by the Eurozone crisis.
We've given up on Europe now to focus 100% on China's domestic market. It won't be easy.
Well, as you heard, Kai, not many signs of hope and optimism in London's Notting Hill. Our poll suggests that Americans are considerably more optimistic than we are over here. Over the next 5 years, 70% of Americans expect the economy to either stay the same or get better. So, Kai, you've been out to one of your local markets in Los Angeles.
All right, so those I know, those are hydrangeas. Those are birds of paradise. That's what they are. I have no idea what those are.
The market's part of the biggest flower district in the country. And the flowers are stacked all over the place, piles and piles of them. The smell, as you might imagine, is incredible. But what you really see, if you let your mind wander past the flowers, is the global economy.
Holland, Ecuador, Colombia, Chile, New Zealand, Australia.
Every day, Pat Dawson imports flowers from 15 different countries for the company he runs, Mayesh Wholesale. His buyers are local, grocery stores and wedding planners and event venues. The flower business, though, is global. So what happens 7,000 miles away, in Greece, let's just say, shows up here on the floor of the flower market. A weaker euro means cheaper tulips from Holland. But all the uncertainty of strikes and debt bailouts just kills confidence.
I think it's been tough in Europe with the uncertainty with the Greek crisis. There's so much tough or bad economic news out there, it's hard to feel like the momentum is something we can just grab and go with.
Arjen Bosma runs Holland Flower Market. It's right around the corner from Pat Dawson.
When people place orders a month in advance, I have to basically say, okay, it might be this price, but it could be this price if the euro goes back up, which is sometimes tough to do because you might price yourself out of the market, but I need to play it safe and need to make money also.
It's $5.95.20.
Here's the thing, though. Sellers want to make money. Consumers don't really want to spend.
Are those chrysanthemums?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
No, they're carnations.
Oh, man. I was so close.
Mary Falkingham is a floral designer, but business for her just isn't what it used to be. Brides are doing their own flowers to cut costs.
There's a lot of Martha Stewarts out there.
Virginia Muskalevskis, for one.
We're buying flowers for my daughter's wedding, which is on Friday.
Okay, no pressure, but you don't have a lot of time.
I know.
Not a lot of time, not a lot of money either.
Why are you doing this yourself? I mean, there are people who do this, like, for a living.
Because it's a way we can save money.
Yeah.
And therein lies the global economy object lesson for the day. Virginia Muskalevskis brought $800 to buy wedding roses. Wound up spending just $575. Great for her, not so good for everybody else.
Well, Kai, the west coast of the U.S. is a long way from the Eurozone. It's extraordinary that the crisis over here could be affecting the price you pay for a bunch of flowers over there.
It is, but, you know, they say one man's crisis is another man's opportunity, and that is clearly the case with the Eurozone crisis. Currency dealers and traders in distressed debt are doing fine with all the market turmoil, and it is true for some long-term investors as well.
But, of course, to take advantage of the opportunities Europe's depressed economies might offer, you need a little bit of cash in the bank, and cash is something that quite a few Chinese companies have in abundance. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz has been exploring how some Chinese businessmen in China's Jiangsu province hope to benefit from Europe's travails.
The office that houses Finchi looks like any other in this booming metropolis. Copy machines, conference rooms, a water cooler. But tucked in between the cubicles of Finchi is a special room. The Chinese have installed a sauna to make Finnish businessmen feel at home as they search for business opportunities in an economy that isn't in a free fall. A place where they can wrap towels around themselves and escape the worries of the crisis back home. And while they pour another ladle of water onto the hot stones, their Chinese partners can turn up the heat on what they'd like out of these new deals, acquiring European technology. That's why Chinese investment manager Zhong Shenwei came to Finchi.
I think China is now facing a historic opportunity. We need core technology, but we can't develop it on our own. So we need to look to outside resources to help us transform our economy as soon as possible.
Zhong says he'll play his part by purchasing a small Finnish tech company and acquiring their technology. This fits neatly into a broader plan etched out by China's government to transform the country from workshop of the world to a center for global innovation. Zhong says the Eurozone crisis will help China get there faster. At a factory in the Yangtze Delta city of Changzhou, workers make hydraulic cylinders that'll be used in excavators and cranes. 5 years ago, workers at this plant run by the Chinese company Sunda had no idea how to make these precision parts. That was before 2009, when the Finnish company Norhydro moved here and showed them how. It was all part of a partnership deal, says Norhydro CEO Yurio Cho.
We are coming to here. We have learned Chinese culture, how to do the work in China, how we go into China market. Of course, we have to give something to them. So it's a win-win situation.
Trogue says Norhydro's sales dipped by a third when the Eurozone crisis struck. But sales have bounced back thanks to his decision to move manufacturing to China, a place that's quickly become the biggest market for Norhydro's products. But he's carefully guarding the company's core technology from being copied and sold in the Chinese market.
Of course, everybody's saying that if you are coming to China, everybody's copying. But everybody's also copying in the Western world. But you have to run faster than the others.
But other companies have a hard time keeping up. 1,000 kilometers away in northern Jiangsu province, an empty warehouse with a single worker shows the other side to the EU crisis in China. This factory belongs to the Chinese company Ozo. The company makes kitchen appliances like gas range burners and hoods. Before the EU crisis, Ozo ran two factories, hired 200 workers, and exported half its products to Italy. Now, the company's revenue has fallen by two-thirds. It's closed one factory and just 40 workers remain. On this day, only one worker is actually working. He's slowly sliding a range hood into a box. Ozo's general manager, Wang Daying, shakes his head.
We've given up on Europe now to focus 100% on China's domestic market. It won't be easy. We have to start promoting, marketing, brand building, all of that. This is new for us.
In the absence of a plan, Wang looks to me. It's not every day a European-looking journalist visits your factory. As I leave Wang's lonely warehouse, the other employee snaps some photos of us. They'll be included in the company's new promotional material for the China market. What might look to some as a European endorsement for a company struggling to survive a European crisis.
You're listening to a special Transatlantic Business Daily co-production with me, Justin Rowlatt, in London.
And with me, Kai Rizdal, in Los Angeles.
We've already mentioned the BBC poll of economic optimism in 25 countries. Well, one of the countries right near the top of that list in terms of their outlook for the coming year was Kenya. So we asked Business Daily's regular commentator, Wycliffe Muga, to consider what lies behind the optimism and whether the Eurozone crisis is likely to shake Kenyans' optimistic attitudes.
If you have ever renovated your house or even just painted it and then filled it with nice new furniture, you will know how much this can create a sense of well-being and even of prosperity. I think a similar effect lies behind the economic optimism that Kenyans have. For right now, plans are beginning to bear fruit for a massive investment in infrastructure, which were laid out when the current government came into office 8 years ago. And everywhere you go in Kenya, you will find signs of a government seriously trying to bring economic opportunity to its people. So even though Kenyans remain acutely aware that around half of our population live in extreme poverty, when we look at the many new and vastly improved roads, water pipes and power lines stretching into regions where they had never been seen before, and other major infrastructure improvements, it's hard not to believe that we have good times ahead. The bottom line of such improvements may actually be that you are worse off financially after making them, especially if, like in Kenya, you had to take out loans for this purpose. But all the same, such visible signs of improved fortunes tend to exert a powerful effect on most of us. It is true that people generally respond to economic uncertainty by reducing personal spending. And as Kenya's core markets, both for horticultural exports and tourism, are in Western Europe, and with both vacations and flowers being, at the end of the day, luxuries which can be swiftly abandoned, we are likely to have fewer tourists visiting and fewer flowers sold. More significant, though, whether for good or bad, is a potential long-term loss of faith in the benefits of monetary unions. Developing countries often imitate others when planning for the future, and their planners love to work at creating local versions of what they see working well in richer nations. So the five East African nations of Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, Rwanda, and Burundi have long been preparing for monetary union as part of their attempt to create a single East African economic bloc. Of course, there are many skeptics who believe that such plans for a single currency should never have been put in train, and that free trade across East African borders is all that matters if what we want is new investment and job creation. Still, East Africa's plans for monetary union would be brought to a grinding halt if, as seems likely, the creation of the euro turns out to be a noble experiment which never quite worked as advertised. This is Wycliffe Muga for the BBC World Service in Nairobi.
At the heart of this crisis is debt, the vast debts run up by banks and companies and governments in Europe. The paradox, though, is that the preferred solution to the problem seems to be piling on more debt. So, Justin, can you really borrow your way out of a debt crisis?
Well, Kai, we've lined up somebody who certainly should know the answer to that question. Bill Gross is the co-founder and co-chief investment officer of PIMCO, one of the biggest bond trading companies on the planet. Our survey suggests a real division in attitudes, as we discussed earlier, between the developed and the developing worlds. So I asked him if he thinks that suggests that, to borrow a phrase that was fashionable a couple of years ago, we are now living in a decoupled world.
I think we do, and that's a thesis of our new normal type of economy. It's the decoupling of developed and developing economies. Basically, economies such as China, such as Brazil, such as India, have rather underdeveloped consumer sectors and low levels of debt, just the opposite of developed countries. And so it's possible for them to create debt. It's possible for them to expand their consumer sector because it's very undeveloped. For instance, in China, it's only 30% of the economy, whereas in the United States, it's 70%. So that shows you how far the gap is. And so these countries can still continue to grow because their consumer sectors are very, very underdeveloped.
You keep saying that word, growth, and I'll be gosh darned, I'll say, if anybody can figure out where it's coming from.
Well, it does, as we talked about, comes from the developing country, yeah. But importantly in the developed world, because debt is so high and there are constraints in terms of increasing that debt, and because globalization is working to their detriment as opposed to their benefit. Let me give you a quick example. I mean, globalization is basically allowing jobs and job growth to take place in China and Brazil and India, but it's not allowing it to happen in the developed world because it's substituting for jobs over in the UK and in Euroland and in the US. Basically, the cheaper wages of developing countries is becoming more beneficial for them as opposed to us, and that's a structural problem. It's a problem that really can't be alleviated by lower and lower interest rates.
Well, let me ask a question, Bill, because obviously we're terribly concerned here in Europe about the Eurozone crisis. I mean, you know, people around the world clearly are. But just how much of an issue is it elsewhere in the world, away from Greece and Portugal and Spain, where people really are suffering high levels of unemployment? But, I mean, over on the west coast of America, the east coast of Africa, over in Asia, I mean, how important is the Eurozone crisis?
Well, I think it is, Justin, because you know what happens in Europe and Euroland doesn't stay in Europe or Euroland these days, and that's because trade has become so globalized over the past several decades, and finance and investing has as well, because they go together. And when Greece experiences, for instance, a 50% haircut or a technical default, which is the proposal on the table, then German and French and UK and US banks lose money and they become less creditworthy. And so many money market funds here in the US, for instance, hold this debt. They don't hold Greek debt, but they hold debt in those banks. And while this is nowhere near the situation in 2008 with Lehman Brothers, it's certainly a cause of concern.
As you sit there then, Bill, every day and watch this happen, right, as you trade debt as you do, what's it been like for you to try to figure this out?
Well, it's been day-to-day. Obviously, the policies in Euroland have been day-to-day with Merkel and Sarkozy at each other's throats to a certain extent in terms of accepting their formulation of how things should go. And, of course, with Greece sort of subserviently sitting back and complaining about both, you know, it's a day-to-day thing. To our way of thinking, you know, this plan, this grand plan in Euroland is going to require, you know, $1 trillion or more from the private market, and we wonder, you know, who's going to step up to the plate to provide that money. Perhaps China does, but outside of China, we wonder who's going to provide that money.
Okay, Bill, one last question for you from London. Okay. How long is it going to take us to get out of this crisis?
You know, Rogoff and Reinhardt, who are economists in the United States, they suggest that the time to get out is roughly equivalent to the time to get in, sort of biblical in a way, you know, 7 years of lean following 7 years of fat. And, you know, I'm not so sure it took longer than 7 years to get into this mess. And so to my way of thinking, it'll take longer than 7 years to get out of this mess. It doesn't mean that the world will experience a recession for that period of time, but it does suggest that as long as we're delevering, as long as debt becomes a focal point in terms of fiscal and monetary policies, then we're likely to experience very slow growth in a developed world for a long, long time. And so 7 years plus.
Well, that's a depressing prospect, isn't it, Kai? I mean, obviously the troubles in the Eurozone are a big deal here in Britain, but are ordinary people in LA really talking about, I don't know, Greek bailouts and Italian bond prices?
I think by now in this process, it's been, what, a couple of years with the Greek debt crisis. I think people can talk Greek bailouts and they can talk Eurozone problems. I think when you get into the minutiae of Italian bond yields, that's another problem that they're not conversant with. The big thing, though, over here still, until something cataclysmic happens in Europe, it's still jobs over here and unemployment.
But what, you know, what Bill Gross seems to be saying there is that the problems in Europe are really genuinely beginning to affect the prospects for fundamental things for Americans, like their prospects for their jobs in the future.
Yeah, I think it's mood, right? That's the mood question, and pessimism and confidence, as you talked about in your survey. And that's exactly what's happening over here.
Yeah, sentiment, confidence is now so important, isn't it? It's what determines people's prospects for the future, doesn't it? Well, thanks very much indeed, Kai. You can find out more about the Eurozone crisis at bbc.com/global economy.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.